Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Adam Francisco, and Dan Van Voris. Dr. Keith is away this week, furiously sanding the outside of his cabin, and so he'll join us in some future episodes. But today we are recording episode 5 of Christianity in America, which Dan has been leading us through, and it's been a lot of fun to sit here and just throw questions at you for the last several weeks, and it's been enjoyable for me. I think I could tell you from direct listener feedback, people have been really enjoying the show, and downloads are way up too, so it's kind of cool being able to cover material that we've never done on the show before, which I think makes all the difference, because we go back and look at those topics and really matter and resonate to people, and we've said there's sort of nothing wrong with revisiting a lot of the same topics that we've done, because those same questions and doctrines always seem to come up. But it's a great break to be able to do, to bring somebody on the show who can do an outline of something we've never done or covered before.
Well, we're not Platonists, right? So we don't just have these ideas floating up in some realm above us. Everything is, you know, connected to concrete people. You know, So we've got to know what those people were doing and what they were saying, and that's where the historian can hopefully be some help.
I think had I been quicker when you said we're not Platonists, right? Well, I should have said, well, speak for yourself.
Oh no!
Oh, here it goes.
Not down that rabbit hole.
For 30 years, I've looked over that head and tried to make it look better than it is, and
is it because so many guys, they love it? That's where they gravitate towards, and it's like looking at
there's certainty there.
Yeah, can I say it's like Mila Jovovich, the actress? I know a lot of people look at it and are very attracted, but I look and say, you know, it's just not my thing. Yeah. She's the Platonism of actress.
I think I'm not talking out of school here. One time, when the microphones were off, and Dr. Horton and Dr. Riddlebarger were there, and somehow it got to what they wish they could get rid of in Calvin. Guess what?
Platonism.
Platonism.
Interesting, huh?
Wow.
So how do we get from because I threw us.
Yeah. Well, we're doing Christianity in America, which for the majority of our listeners is pretty relevant, because we are in the United States of America. Most of the listeners are in the United States of America. And there's something about this, because the states aren't that old when you think about it. And so this history is not like recent history, but it's not ancient history. And so you can see as we go through these episodes the impact this has maybe on people, maybe potentially on people's day-to-day lives and the way they worship and things like that, who are listening to this show. So it's a very tangential piece of history for people.
There are so many ways you can go about doing history of Christianity in America. There are all sorts of threads you can follow. I'm interested in a lot of the threads that end up sort of meeting us today in various movements. I think that's a helpful thing for the church, to say, where did this come from?
Think of Dorothy Sayer. She said, we wouldn't have the cults in America and Britain if we had taught our parishes the basics of the heresies.
Yeah, yeah. It's learning, it's knowing, okay, where did this come from? And,
yep.
And so today, and I think the last two classes we're going to do, I keep saying classes because I made an outline, and Caleb, if you can make the outline, or something available so people can follow it.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
I think that we're in the 20th century. And so the first thing we're going to look at fundamentalism and modernism. And we've been teasing that a little bit with some of the stories we've been telling, especially when we get into the Second Great Awakening. And the fundamentalist modernist movement is really the beginning of the 20th century. And so we're going to look at that today. And then next week, we're going to look at the sort of modern church and where it's headed.
And where things are going, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is rubber hits the road. I think a lot of people are going to hear fundamentalism and modernism, and their ears are going to perk up, because maybe a lot of people have heard about it, have a rough idea what we mean, but seeing sort of the contextual development of these two things is going to be exciting.
And don't underestimate the fact that this was in the news. Right? Mm-hmm. This was particular in a way that, there's stuff happening right now at the Southern Baptist Convention, but I don't really know what that is. And CNN or whatever, they're not really picking that up, or the LA Times or what have you. But back then, this fundamentalist modernist controversy, it was all over the news. Hmm. It was everywhere. Who's the Baltimore writer?
Mencken or Lippmann?
Yeah, Mencken followed the Scopes trial, which is we'll look at in a bit. Mencken was all over that.
Yep.
And really fast. I mean, this was front page stuff. And so fundamentalism and modernism is not just for church history. It's just part of American history.
Well, great. Well, right before we dive into that, I just wanted to share with listeners, if you're new to the show, the Think Fellows is part of a bigger podcast network, 1517 Podcast Network. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts. You can see 14 different shows there, including a daily one that Dan does. It's called Christian History Almanac. It's 5 minutes a day. It's a pretty great way to open up your morning, I think. We have long-form podcasts like this, Thinking Fellows, 30 minutes in the New Testament, 40 minutes in the Old Testament, which are exegetical. We've got all, and basically everything in between. We're covering all sorts of different topics every day of the week now, which is pretty amazing. So if you're looking for daily content, you can go see podcasts, blogs, and the rest of sort of digital media over at 1517.org. All right, Dan. So I'm going to leave it to
you. Well, you know, we were talking about Plato, and actually I'm going to tie this in because rather than being Platonist, and we don't bend that way, if I bend anyway, it's towards Aristotle. And the idea that I'm going to look at everything on the ground,
yep,
and I'm going to do my very best to start to organize what's there,
yep,
and call them what they are, yep, and then see what happens, right? It's the deductive, yep, approach, Rod, that you taught us in
inductive
school. Inductive, sorry. Oh, no. The inductive approach. And so when we look at early 20th century American Christian history, there are so many different threads we could follow. There are so many different ways we could organize all, sure, the pieces, parts. I think the first thing to do is to break it down between the fundamentalists and the modernists and just get a definition out there.
Yeah, let's do it.
And say that in large part, the evangelical mainline at that time churches were dividing into fundamentalists or modernists. A fundamentalist is, there's all kinds of definitions. It comes from a book called The Fundamentals,
yep,
that was funded by a guy named Lyman Stewart, who's, yep, an oil man out of Texas. He founded Biola. And Reuben Torrey, who was at Biola, he was one of the editors of this series called The Fundamentals. And,
yep,
it went to 10 or 15 volumes.
Yep.
And it was basically doctrines on everything. And
a systematic
by holding
theology
to that. Yeah, it was. In some ways, not a systematic theology like you'd expect. But if you go to it, you know, the very first, it's articles written by different theologians.
Okay.
And many of them we'd look to with great respect.
Absolutely.
Orr from Scotland.
B.B. Warfield.
Warfield, a lot of guys,
yeah,
who would not call themselves fundamentalists, but were perfectly willing to write for that, the fundamentals.
And that's where this gets tricky. So Reuben Torrey, later in his life, bemoaned what happened to the term fundamentalism.
Yep.
Because for those guys, originally, 1910, 1915, it means essentially supernatural theology,
mm, yep,
with a high view of the word,
yep,
and a Jesus who dies in a substitutionary way for us.
Yep.
Right? That's what it was. It wasn't that out. There's nothing too peculiar about that at all, right? Mm, especially,
right,
Protestant tradition. It becomes something more. And that's because of the history.
Okay.
And what it becomes is a kind of theological precisionism, not just in these five things, but in everything they do, and a kind of morally tinged individualism, right? So think of those two things. So a precisionism theologically, and sometimes a very rigid
kind of like
theology.
A scholasticism? Or
yeah, very much. I think that there's parallels there. Mm-hmm. And then a morally tinged individualism, which ties right in with the history of the American church and that kind of individual. De Tocqueville, Adam, De Tocqueville talked about this, that the Americans are peculiarly individualistic, mm-hmm, and we see it in everything they do. And fundamentalism is private religion. It's the romantic religion of the 19th century. It's the Great Awakening, sort of inner bosom burning. That's what that is. Now, what's modernism? Modernism is...
That's easier.
It much easier. Anti-supernatural.
Yep.
Modernism says, a priori, it didn't happen.
Yep.
And the foundations from this, I mean, we can go back to German scholarship in the 19th century.
Yep.
Right, is really where it starts to make its way. And then it comes over with a whole group of theologians from America who were told, go to Germany and study.
Mm. Oh.
And then they came back, and you have a guy, you know, Machen, who we're going to meet in just a bit, Machen
lost
said
his faith.
Yeah. He said I once, I think it was maybe Boltmann or something he was reading.
It was earlier.
Earlier.
But yeah. He lost his faith doing study in Germany.
Yeah. And, you know, guys that would come back and start Christianity Today, thinking of like McIntyre and some others, they did the same thing. Hmm. You know, they went and studied in Germany. And sometimes, I mean, it gave them a lay of the land, which was interesting for the theological debates, which kind of stopped happening after the heyday of Christianity Today. The fundamentalists, their theological precisionism on certain doctrines, they start to become less relevant doctrines. They become things that people aren't really debating, and so they debate amongst themselves, and they become kind of, well, we'll see them supplanted by the evangelicals.
Okay.
But that's for next time.
So there becomes some infighting, and they cannibalize themselves.
Fundamentalist is hard, but you get it in a way. It's sort of Mencken said of Puritanism. It's the sneaking suspicion that somewhere someone is having a good time.
Yep.
Fundamentalism is that kind of, or Justice Potter's definition of pornography. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. Right?
Uh-huh.
So modernism, the other side of the coin, nothing miraculous.
All of this fought primarily in the Presbyterian Church.
Yeah, yeah. In the Northeast, where we have the writers and the printing presses and the big newspapers, and so oftentimes, Adam, I know we've seen this teaching just sort of broad American history. It sort of needs an asterisk that says Northeast America, right? I mean, we really do a lot of that. And I've got friends from the South who say, you're missing a whole bunch of history because we're so focused. But it's where the news media was.
Yep.
And so we have these pictures. And what we've seen is that the template in the Presbyterian Church was nothing new to, I mean, we're going to see that happen in most of the modern denominations.
Yep.
Right? So it's something that happens. The background to all of that, and really where I put the background at the beginning of fundamentalism, is something called the Niagara Bible Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that was, it was actually a whole group of meetings that took place in the mid-19th century and around the time of the Second Great Awakening. And they'd actually take place all over the place, and they were called believers' meetings, right?
Hmm.
So you can jump to the present and see that with certain services and the seeker versus believer.
A lot tilted to eschatology?
That's where it's going to get there, because C.I. Schofield is going to be at the most popular one, which takes place in Niagara.
Okay.
And so that year, all the big guys come, Charles Erdman and others, and they start to pin down what's wrong with modernism. They come out with 14 statements. Five of them are going to be the big five that are coming up, the Auburn Affirmation, what splits the whole church. But they've got 14. And in those 14, they go eschatological.
Yep.
Hmm. And so that's the first thing that gets kind of curious.
And the question in the laity's mind was, how do I tell if my pastor is a modernist? And to help those people, it was to come to their aid. Do I have a modernist pastor, and what do I ask?
What do you think about the end times?
And I mean, is the big problem then that you're having somebody deny things like resurrection and like central, what we would say are central?
Absolutely.
Doctrines?
Yeah, I mean, those aren't the central topics that they're talking about, right? The central topics become, you know, if I, it's a shibboleth. If I can say I believe in a pre-rapture, mid-something dispensation, you know that I'm a Dallas Theological Seminary guy, not a, you know, Tubingen guy.
Hmm.
Yep.
And so that's where, and that's interesting because fundamentalism and evangelicalism, you have to understand the eschatology because it really does play, especially in the 20th century where everything is, you know, blowing up and going to hell.
And most of our Lutherans would say, what is that? I mean, really, because it was, I think, you who told me in your pre-dissertation days you were going to write some on this, and you told me, when I look back at the 16th century, we didn't have anybody interested in it, really, and so we went to the streets and said, who's selling? Because we're buying.
I'll come back on another episode because it's Nicholas Selnicker and David Treves.
Mm.
And they are Orthodox guys who basically turn on their version of TBN and pick up the wackiest eschatology and then try and pin it off as sort of Lutheran. And the backflips they're trying to do. It's hilarious. It's a good story for another time. But eschatology becomes so big that the next sort of big step for me in fundamentalism is the C.I. Scofield Bible.
Yes.
Is published. A long time ago on this show, I asked you guys about study Bibles.
Yeah. Yep.
Because they make me nervous sometimes because they're setting up the stage for what questions are going to be asked and how to approach that. The Concordia Study Bible has like 18 pages on Jonah, and then Jonah, which is, you know, 5 pages.
Yeah.
They talk more about the book than the book. But Scofield did that with dispensational theology.
Yep.
And so he was going to show everyone.
Everywhere.
Exactly. If you want to spread something, make a study Bible. I mean, that's the lesson in history.
Yeah.
And if it catches on, you're gonna get everyone going your way. And the charts and the graphs.
Yep.
And presented not as a theory.
No, as fact.
But as, this is how you read Daniel. And frankly, Daniel and Revelation are hard to read. And so if you've got charts, sure.
this guy must understand it.
Yeah.
That's
what you're left with.
So 1910, the Presbyterian Church, the Northern Presbyterian Church, and remember last time we talked about the split, Northern and Southern. And we said, that's slavery, that's political, but it's also theological.
Mm-hmm.
The Southern frontier theology style, the Northern, they were the bastions of orthodoxy. And the Northern Presbyterian Church looked at the Niagara Conference and said, well, there's too much there. We'll take these 5. And so in 1910, the Northern Presbyterian Church gives us the 5 doctrines. I'll list them off. Mm-hmm. It's inerrancy.
Yep.
And that's defined by B.B. Warfield. That's going to get tricky, but you want to read B.B. Warfield on inerrancy, and that's what they're defending, not what some guy, you know, at Dallas Seminary today is saying about inerrancy. The virgin birth is the next one. Substitutionary atonement. So what's happening on the cross isn't just a moral example, but there's something happening.
Yep.
Bodily resurrection of Jesus.
Yep.
And the authenticity of Christ's miracles. So if you could say yes to that, technically, you're the first fundamentalist, right? That's all it meant. Now, because of Niagara and because of the eschatology and because of the trajectory of the popular church, fundamentalists are going to become something very different, such that the term gets dropped about 1970, right? People stop using it. The use just drops off the chart.
I remember back to those days, and one of the things was they wanted to not be accused of racism.
Interesting.
And what could they use as the new term? Their new seminary was Fuller Theological Seminary.
Mm.
And so they said, we're going to call ourselves evangelicals.
Hmm. Interesting. And there's also, this is the next show, but the growth of the moral majority and this very peculiar kind of Christianity meets prosperity gospel meets, Victorian model, Victorian morals. Mm-hmm. We'll get there, and Rod will just cringe the whole time.
is there a relationship to modern day Bible colleges still to these to the fundamentalist movement?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is where the Bible college sort of movement, the Bible college movement actually starts in England. And it starts in England because there are tests for religious entrance into Oxford and Cambridge. And so if you're a dissenter of any kind from the Church of England, you can't study at those two schools.
Hmm.
Well, they started to realize, well, that's a bad idea. And so they reversed it. They reversed the Religious Test Act. So all the people that went to these Bible colleges went off to Oxford and Cambridge, because why wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got all these schools across England, and they become denominational ministry schools. That kind of Bible college, the connection between 19th century evangelicalism and what's happening in England in the 19th century, YMCA, mm-hmm. eschatology stuff, the Keswick movement. I mean, it's interesting. but nonetheless, you're going to have that kind of, those connections.
Maybe a little correction, though. You don't go off to Oxford, you go up to Oxford.
Up to Oxford. Okay, sorry. But yeah, so it really, I mean, I think that when you're looking at history, and someone mentioned this the other day, and I wish I could footnote it for you, but they said that when you want to do history and you want to look at political change, start with the school boards. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes it's the schools where we see the rubber hit the road for people and politics. And this is true with religious test acts in the 17th, 18th century. It's true in the 1950s with what books are being banned and you know, that's the conversation. But it's kind of like in the 20th century become the last meeting place, in a way, outside the church is PTA. And you know, I be that what it may, it's interesting when we look at how many times school changes are indicative of the bigger change. Brown versus Board of Education, integration in schools, prayer in schools, and the place of prayer in public life. It always has its practical stuff down in what are we doing in the schools, because there's a you know, Rod, you know, there's a kind of Charlie horse between the ears between a kind of federalist movement and a, you know, wide public school system, but that's for another time. Speaking of schools, this is the time when all the schools are growing. I mentioned Biola. There's a place called Evangelical Theological Seminary, which will become Dallas Theological Seminary. And these places, so the Bible colleges, which have been around, now want a bit of that...
Prestige,
exactly.
Is it Moody included in this?
Moody's included. Yeah, Moody's one of the oldest. Moody's 1889.
Yeah.
Which makes it kind of the oldest. And of course, Moody, his connection to England is all over the place. So you find colleges. And then the other thing that we start to see pop up are associations and councils, right? Before it would
be... Governing bodies, huh?
Yeah, governing bodies that were kind of pan-confessional in a way. So the World Council of Churches is one of the big ones. And that was Rod oofing because they were a group that epitomized modernism. And so what we find is as this is happening, there's a break off with the American Council of Churches. The American Council of Churches...
McIntyre,
absolutely. And then that's going to split a couple different ways. And it's Luther's example of the drunk guy on the horse, right? Just one extreme to the other extreme. But we see these councils, and we say, okay, what are the councils doing, and who's congregating with whom when it comes to theological and social matters? And you can tell a lot. You know, what are the Methodists doing? Well, is your church part of the World Council of Churches or the American Council of Churches? And it's just another badge, another something where you can show the
laity. Shibboleths.
Shibboleths. I'm a Bible believer. Trust me.
Yep.
Right, that's on one side. The story of the Presbyterian Church is fascinating. I think my first show ever on Thinking Fellows was all about Machen.
Yes, it was.
So you can go back and look at that story.
That book is required reading.
Christianity and Liberalism is the book, 1923.
He decimated the modernist underpinnings.
There's a hymn, God of Grace and God of Glory. And whenever I sing it, whenever I hear it, I can only think about the guy who wrote it, who was Harry Emerson Fosdick, who is the guy against which Christianity and liberalism is after, right?
Yep.
Fosdick gives a sermon called Shall the Fundamentalists Win? Uh-huh. If you want to look at a time when fundamentalist all of a sudden becomes a bad word, go to the 20s. He's at a Presbyterian, a church in New York. Well, Machen ends up, you know, over these issues, splitting and starting Westminster Theological Seminary.
Yep.
And the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. What I find fascinating about all of that is a point made by Francis Schaeffer, which within a year of the OPC breaking off, it splits into two other bodies. And it really, it's like a crack on your window that goes, and all of a sudden, and it, that's the history of, really, of Presbyterians in a particular way in America.
Yeah, I said to Dr. Horton, when you guys split, you go everywhere.
Yeah.
When we split, we go confessional or not confessional.
Yeah, it tends to be more binary.
And further than that, it's pietism versus confessional orthodoxy. But that's about it for us.
Yeah, and there's so many different... And these churches are much more steeped in the American have-it-your-own-way style. Right? The church shopping, you know, this idea that I'm just going to find the one where the pastor believes like me and what's on my list. And that's, you know, that's a story. Some of the people that are kind of popping up around this time period, we mentioned Machen versus Fosdick. Charles Fuller is a really interesting guy to follow as well. You mentioned Fuller Seminary, which Fuller Seminary was kind of when fundamentalism became a bad word. Charles Fuller said, I don't think it has to be.
Yep.
And we're going to set up something that is the best of the best academically.
Yep.
And out here in California. And it really was a kind of bulwark.
It was.
For modernism outside the just Presbyterianism. And so some of the debates start to spread around a little bit because that debate is taken into other churches. And so Fuller says, all right, let's pick up the cause. And so it gets hard definitionally, but that's why I like to say, you know, the fundamentalist has the moral tinge to it. But the original fundamentalists, I don't even know what they're like Protestants, evangelicals.
Yeah,
it's hard to say.
It seems
right?
Like Orthodox.
Historic Christianity, right? It's hard to define. Not that historic Christianity is not hard to define. Mm-hmm. It's hard to define people when they're not good little soldiers, you know, in Europe underneath the ruler going to the building they're supposed to go to, right? Everyone's spreading out everywhere. So the historian looks at that mess and says, well, I'll see what kind of, okay, what's happening? And in this case, you know, the big distinction is the modernist-fundamentalist distinction. But fundamentalist coming to the rest of the kind of academic world, conservative academic world, through Charles Fuller. The kind of, you know, the big one is Scopes, you know, when it comes to popular. And Scopes trial.
The trial. Yeah, trial.
The monkey trial, yeah, which is, you know, it's like a lot of historical things, the story, you know, kind of debunks the myth in that the ACLU wanted to challenge this law. And so they said, who among us can claim to have taught that or will teach that, and then we'll back you up when you go to court? And so John T. Scopes is 25, 26, single.
Bibliographic reference, there's a whole magazine on the issue, Christian History Magazine, on the Scopes trial.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I went to the museum last year. I was in Dayton, Tennessee. Went to the courthouse. Inherit the Wind is the famous play and then movie that's about that.
Yep.
What's interesting is Scopes never actually taught evolution. Afterwards, he's like, yeah, I couldn't. I thought I did, maybe, who knows. And then, you know, Scopes actually wins the trial. Oh, no, Scopes loses the trial and is fined, you know, $50, and then that's waived. Yeah. So, I mean,
Bryan involved?
Yes. Mm-hmm. William Jennings Bryan and Charles Darrow. Yeah, those were the two guys. Of the century.
Yep.
And it really, we mentioned Mencken before, but Mencken following it every day for the Baltimore Sun.
Yeah.
And painting the picture of the fundamentalist as yokel, as Southern yokel.
Yeah.
And then the modernist as Northeast elite. Right, and that
weird
distinction,
like a swap,
that's where it kind of, you know, the fundamentalist yokel thing
comes
together.
It's strange because if I'm not mistaken, like Warfield, for example, is pretty open to an old earth.
Warfield says Calvin teaches evolution. He doesn't understand it quite, and we're not going to say how that works. But he says without a doubt. I was just reading this. I was looking it up because I wanted to make sure. Warfield says, Calvin says, yes, I say yes too.
So those early fundamentalists, because the 5 points you mentioned, they don't mention anything about young earth or that's not a debate yet.
Nope.
But then
that
you
totally
fast forward
wrapped
couple
up
decades,
in what it
decade
is,
and a half
it?
Or so, that becomes the shibboleth of this redefined fundamentalism. Is that
absolutely? It's the question, what's being asked and what's being offered, and how do we know what you're teaching? Mm-hmm. And
you still get asked that. I mean, we've been directly asked that on the show.
Oh, well, now it's a what do I believe tab on the computer, right? And
yeah,
click it and it says this is what we believe. Maybe they'll have a confession linked, but mostly it'll just be sort of standard things. But they decide what are the important things. So Biola, for instance, right? I mean, to teach there, you've got to believe in a certain kind of
eschatology.
And right, so they've moved more into the 14-point mold of the Niagara Conference. That's more their heritage. Mm-hmm. The 5-point mold, what do you know, is more Presbyterian, right? See the irony. And so with those five things, the Presbyterians, Machen, the OPC, it's a break off of the main line. What we're going to see in the last little outline is sort of evangelicalism and the main line being the rest of the story. But it comes from fundamentalism, modernism, you know, the trials, the church schisms. And remember, all of this is happening in the context of World War I, which prior to World War I, we are optimistic as anything, right? And so the eschatology is, let's go. It's post-millennial.
Yep.
And so when does the premillennial thing happen? After 1918. And we see, oh, then it starts, and then after World War II, okay, of course. Yeah, we're not going to make onward Christian soldiers. No. It's going to get worse. And then after obviously Israel and what's happening there in the late 40s, it goes elsewhere. But it's interesting to just kind of put it in its place there.
So modernism sheds off the supernatural. What does it replace it with? With empiricism?
No, it's moral.
Yeah, it's you know,
it's like deism. No miracles, no supernatural, but we can get a moral message out of this. And they did. That's how they did it.
And the social gospel, remember, is taken off in the age of industrialization, the end of the 19th century, poor working conditions, people living in right? And so the church rightly says, hey, how can we help? And then it starts to get really involved, and then that becomes the change of the focus. And then by the time you lose miracles, what's there? Oh, well, this robust social gospel.
Yep.
And that's
Rauschenbusch.
Yep. Rauschenbusch, Jacob Riis, Numbers.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense why why substitutionary atonement becomes one of sort of the points that you said, right? Because moral example would be the filler there.
Yep.
Things like that.
Is this connected to, you know, in the Gilded Age, Carnegie and the Gospel of Wealth? And is it all sort of one package? Modernism, progressivism, moralism?
Oh, yeah. So it's pre-World War I optimism. Mm. And we see it in the church. We see it in politics. You see it everywhere, right? You see it in foreign missions. We're going to usher in the kingdom of Christ. They were heady days.
And what's the... I mean, I don't... Obviously, you probably couldn't locate one cause, but... What are the underlying causes? Is this Darwin, you know, this evolutionary view of things that's emerged? Marxism, Hegelism, or what is it?
Is it because
culture influences theology?
Sure,
and certainly in this particular historical epoch. So what is it that pushes people in the direction of modernism?
Oh,
to be hip and with it, with the times and all the contemporary
secular philosophies. That's the tradition that we get from the Enlightenment, right? Mm-hmm. The Enlightenment and modernism are both anti-supernatural, and there's a real emphasis there on because we'll get, we'll say, it seems to be that there's something there which says, I don't want to be made fun of with the big kids.
Okay.
Right?
So intellectually respectable.
Exactly,
and
right? And that kind
compatible
of...
Compatible with the university even?
Yeah, yeah. And really the growth of the American university is just the German university. I mean, even in the style.
Yeah. Yep.
If you look at England, if you look at places where you don't take all the classes, you don't do everything. We do it very, very German, you know, for what it's worth.
And then even with the fundamentalists, they start their own colleges, right? So sort of an anti-university type.
Yeah. I mean, there's we'll do it on our own. And there's some very good models of that, right? There's some very good models of saying Christian education can be the best kind of education. As a matter of fact, Luther kind of starts the thing. And we can make a Wittenberg model. Now, it goes off in a whole bunch of different directions because we're America, and like the glass splitting, the windshield, we just break in a million different ways. It's maybe in our DNA. But Adam, when you said what's kind of behind modernism, the desire to be accepted in the university, you know, I think there's a headiness to Marxism, which says we're going to figure this out. We're going to figure this market thing out, and then don't worry, everything's going to be, it's utopian, right? Mm-hmm. The utopian worldview, and it comes from, you know, Darwin. Well, if everything's been moving up so far, why not? Maybe it's just going to keep getting better. And so I think that whole spirit we talked about on another episode of Darwin, Marx, Wagner, there's this really heady, hey, we're going to do it. And then, you know, the market economy is really working well for a certain group of people in the 19th century, the Gilded Age or whatever. I mean, people have figured out how to work it. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you get the giant names. And that's where you get the sort of making of America brought to you by Carnegie and Ford and
Rockefeller,
exactly.
But they would, not in their defense, but Carnegie would say something like, if I remember correctly, though there's this huge disparity of wealth, overall, everybody's been elevated.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, warm showers, you know, toilets and doors, right? It's all going to be there. I mean, that's
and but he locates it. It's almost, I think we maybe talked about this years ago when you came on Thinking Fellows about immanentizing the eschaton. Mm-hmm. We're going to create a this utopian
on our own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you can see it in every movement. You can always see it in just about everyone is going to make it about now somehow. Mm-hmm. We're going to see in the next episode with Pentecostals and that movement.
And Christianity isn't about now.
No.
It's about back then.
Yeah.
And in the future.
And you're dead.
Yeah. Now, I mean, it's a now and not yet is our eschatology, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when we see culture really put all their weight on now, we say, what? Let's remember the not yet. I mean, I said this before, but that's one of the uses, I think, of history, is not that we're necessarily going to be brighter, but at least we can see, okay, let's not go wrong that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what Lewis, C.S. Lewis said, that it's not that, you know, two heads are smarter. It's just they're less likely to go in the same wrong direction.
Yeah.
So for what that's worth. But the what's behind modernism is, you know, ultimately, what's the in the garden? I mean, you can go all the way back to it's a denial of the claim. Mm-hmm. And it's going to come out in all sorts of different ways. But it's saying, no, I think it's a different way. We can do it. We can do it otherwise. We the modern. We the smart. We the elect, the elite. And
now it's the brights.
Yeah.
It was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, I mean, how often do you still
or the woke? Hear
that? Well, there you go.
That's today.
I mean, the woke. You hear like you see something tragic happen. You go, well, how could this be in 2019?
Yeah.
We've come so, you know, like in 2019, there shouldn't be tragedy anymore.
Well, yeah, that same idea. It's you know, that it's. And there is something there that we do have this sort of hope, longing for eternity and something better, and we know we're made for something else. But anyone with two eyes is just going to look around and say, "Oh, we're screwed."
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Chesterton who wrote, "There's at least one doctrine of Christianity that is empirical." Yeah.
Doctrine of sin. Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Right in front of our eyes all the time.
Do you think some of that too has to do with the, I mean, just the really fast amount of technological advancement happening too? I mean, I even think now it's pretty easy to get caught up in ourselves when like you said, hot showers and things like this, when you look at your life and your day-to-day life is pretty easy.
Well, I don't want to go on a tangent, but no, the market is designed to amuse us. And the market is designed to give us what we need so we can consume as often as possible. And what they know, and they might not know it, you know, implicitly, but they know that we're curved in on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the more you can make me tickle that little thing by updating my Facebook or putting this there, they're tickling the original thing. I mean, no wonder it's popular.
Sometimes my dad and I have conversations about why don't people like rise up now? Like you see some, you know, things happening from governments, mass taxation, whatever, you name it. There's lots of people very upset, but not a lot of people willing to do anything on either side of political issues. And it seems to me like it comes down to, well, it was a lot easier when you were already out in a field or repairing boats and life sort of sucked in the day-to-day too. And it's a lot harder when you can be upset about things, but go on and turn on any TV show in the world and sit on your air-conditioned couch. And
revolutions in the past tend to happen in the early to mid-summer.
When it's
really
hot.
Yeah. When it's hot.
I mean, murder rate goes up.
That's what happens, right? We live in an age of so much comfort and leisure that absolutely, it's easier and in a way people are more prone. And listen, we're, you know, where we are, where we're at. But I think to get back to this idea that, you know, I think especially when we get to the next episode and we start to look at sort of where we are today, we'll be able to tie it back through these various threads, fundamentalism, modernism being a big one.
Well, great. I mean, I think we've made time. Unless there's anything quick you want to add, maybe we could tell people what year-ish we sort of are at too.
Yeah, let me just do that real fast. I mean, this is, you know, Niagara's 1870s, and the American Council of Churches is 1941, and so it's really, you know, I would say post-Civil War to World War II. Post-World War II, everything's going to change, and it's going to change in large part because of the GI Bill. And everyone's going to college, and churches say, we need to minister to those kids. So that's where it's going. But think just now, post-Civil War to World War II. Next one will be World War II to the present.
Awesome. Hey, thank you for joining us. If the Thinking Fellows or any other podcast or project at 1517 has had an impact on you, do please consider supporting our efforts. We are completely donor-funded. So if you go to 1517.org, there's a donate button in the upper right-hand corner, and you can fill in whatever amount you can do. But like you said, we need listener support. It doesn't just sort of happen. And so if this has been impactful to you or educational in any ways, please do consider supporting what we do. All right, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time. Bye.